With me right now, I'm very happy to say, from the Lafayette Public Library, are Emma Guillory and Beth Chasson, here to talk about lots of activities going on there. I always love getting your press releases. They're just chock full of things to do and read and experience, and you all are doing just a fabulous job making sure there are activities that appeal to everyone and that have something to do with literacy and culture and books, and it's all such a wonderful mix that you all put together.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, and our programmers are really to the ones responsible for that, and they really work very, very hard, and we're appreciative that they give us so much great information to come out and talk about.
Exactly, and I mean, that's why we're here. We're the public library, and we want to make sure that everybody knows that we've got all kinds of things to that they can learn with, they can develop skills with, they can have fun with, they can do stuff with their family. I mean, we've got all kinds of things.
Right, and of course, you know, we cover South Louisiana, so we want to encourage people in other parishes to visit their libraries and find out what's being offered.
For sure.
You'll be talking about the branches within the Lafayette Parish
Correct.
System, the Lafayette Public Library system, and the facilities are getting better and better in the system. I know that they're starting work now on what we used to call the main library.
We still call it
still
that.
Call the main library.
And it will always be the main library. We're very excited about the renovations going on
there. Right, but some lovely facilities that are already in place, and people enjoy going to them so much. So since we're getting close, we're already 1 week finished into February. Valentine's Day is coming up, even though everyone's thinking about Mardi Gras right now. Valentine's Day is just a couple days after, and you all have a really nice activity planned around Valentine's.
We do. It's for the weekend right after Valentine's Day, Saturday, February the 16th. It's a program called Stories with Heart, and it's a Valentine's Day romance authors panel, and that's going to take place at the South Regional Library. And we're having three pretty famous romance authors come in, and their names are Julia Quinn, Eloisa James, and Connie Brockway, and we're talking New York Times best-selling authors. Two of them are Harvard-educated. One of them actually has a PhD and is a Shakespearean professor. And so they're going to come
writes
in.
Writes romance novels.
Exactly. That's it. And she talks about the dichotomy of being, you know, a high-level professor and that. So they're going to come in and they're going to talk about their latest collaborative effort, which is a book called The Lady Most Willing. And then local author Deborah LeBlanc is going to moderate this discussion. And then they're going to do a book sale and signing afterwards. So people are going to be able to ask questions about how romance novels are written in collaboration like this and just kind of what their experiences are. So it's going to be an awesome program for romance lovers.
All right. So and do you have information like that up on your website?
Absolutely.
Because I know people are going to want to be taking notes on
this.
So you can just listen and go check out the website afterwards. So romance, do you all read romances?
I can't say I do, but it's you know, they've got their fans out there, and
it's
I think that
genre.
I don't think there's anything to squawk at. If you like reading and you like romance, feel free to read it.
Right. And what's fascinating to me is how many different genres within that genre.
We were just talking about that the other day in the office, and I was talking about whenever I was in college and I had a feminist professor who wrote under a pen name. She wrote romances. I can remember somebody kind of scoffing at romances in class one day, and she tore the student apart and said that this was a legitimate branch of literature and all this kind of stuff. And so we were actually talking about there's a break off of Amish romance that's even in there that we carry at the library. So there's all kinds of different romances that you could find something you enjoy for sure.
Right. And you know, it's interesting talking about these Harvard-educated authors who are writing romances. It's a structure that they use to hang all kinds of things on. And it's a really nice way of people falling immediately into something that feels familiar and perhaps experiencing some great writing and scholarship along
that's
the way.
That's it. And I think that's an excellent way to put it. And romance fans are some of our most rabid library patrons who are super passionate, who are always reading. I'm sure people that we're going to talk about our 100 book club, and those are the people that are going to easily read their 100 books because they're good reads, they're easy reads, and like you said, it's so easy to fall in love with those stories over and over again.
Right, and you expectantly wait for that next installment.
Exactly.
It's almost like serial reading, you
exactly.
know, but it's a full novel.
Well, and understand too that a lot of the classic literature has also got a good amount of romance in it too. I'm a big fan of Jane Austen, so you know that's romance from that generation. So I think that you know, romance, love, that's all things that people like to read about and like to, you know,
definitely
delve into. So.
And anything, of course, that gets people reading.
That's
exactly.
It. We'll take it.
So what is the name of the program?
So it's called Stories with Heart. And again, that's going to be Saturday, February the 16th at 2 p.m. at the South Regional Library. And for all of this information and information about the authors, you can visit our website, LafayettePublicLibrary.org.
So great way to celebrate Valentine's Day a couple days later. And also, if you want a little break from Mardi Gras, it's a good way to absorb yourself in something a little bit
Definitely.
Different as well. And it's a free program.
Like all things at the library, that's usually what we say. Everything's free of charge at the library. So come on down and see us.
All right. Stories with Heart on Saturday. And again, that's just the start of what you all have going on. You mentioned your 100 Books Club. What
yes,
is that?
This has been something that we're all really, really excited about within the library. It's the 100 Book Club, and it's a challenge to our readers to read 100 books in the calendar year of 2013. So if you hadn't been reading for January, now's the time to get on board. So it comes out to about 2 books a week. And so we're just challenging readers to read. It's open for everybody from age 6 and up. So people with children, it's a fantastic way to kind of incentivize. You know, we're going to have prizes whenever people are done. And so to sign up for this program, they can either visit our website, LafayettePublicLibrary.org, or come into any of our 10 branches around the parish, and we'll sign you up there. So,
but you don't have to get tested on it, do you?
No. And we're just really excited because it's definitely getting people to read. We've already gotten more than, I think, 2,000 books logged from all the various participants who are doing it. And it's just really exciting to know that people are challenging themselves, challenging their friends, their neighbors, their kids, their families. And it's just, you know, that's the whole point. We want everybody to read.
Yeah. And I think a lot of kids in the parish may be used to, I guess, the Star Readers. I don't know
right.
if you saw that same program, but something in the schools that really encouraged kids to read a lot of books.
Exactly. And it's wonderful. And it's like she said, we're seeing offices that are trying to have competitions with everybody, you know, challenging each other to read. I think I can read more books than you. And so, like you said, anything to get people reading. And it's been a very exciting for us to see from the beginning how pumped up Lafayette's been about this project.
Right. And are you giving t-shirts out?
We are, actually. We're going to have prizes at the end of the year for everybody who completes that goal. But even if you don't complete the goal, we want you to get into it, see how well you can do. A lot of people up front say, I could never read 100 books. Why not try? You don't know. You know, you don't know how well you'll do.
I was just thinking that would be a very nice t-shirt to be able to claim, you know, the
100
exactly.
books. Exactly. That's our point.
You'd be an elite club. You know, and we actually have bumper stickers right now at our branches that people mm-hmm. can pick up whenever they sign up, and they say, join the club, and it has the 100 book clubs in our logo. So, you know, I have one on my car, and it's exciting to see, you know, looking for other people, the other readers in Lafayette as I drive around town. So
definitely.
Members of the club.
Yeah, just don't read while you're driving.
Bad idea.
No.
Unless it's an audiobook. Which counts.
Okay, so that does count.
Audiobooks count, ebooks count. Anything that's a book, not a magazine, not a comic book per se, but just, you know, real
with
books.
Some formal
exactly.
Narrative structure.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm sure people, their ears perked up with that, you know, that could be an audiobook there. The 100 Book Club, any of the branches have information, or on your website, you've got
exactly.
information.
Right, exactly. You can sign up at any of our 10 branches anywhere in the parish. And then again, on the website, you can sign
All
up
right.
as well.
And is this an ongoing project too, or is it just for this 1 year? Or
we hope that it'll last. I mean, we're kind of it's in its infancy, so we're looking at the participation, and we're going to try to decide from there. But you know, why not? And why not just stop at 2013? Why not read 100 books every year? You
That's
know,
right. I could see families with lists on their walls.
Exactly.
I mean,
absolutely,
you know, checking off.
And
those
if you
books.
Had those, it's kind of like donating for a KRVS fundraiser at the end. Whenever you have a bunch, you know, to show that you've participated every year, and you have, you know, 6 or 7 T-shirts or mugs. You know, it's something to be really proud of. And I think that we've been so pleased with the amount of people that have been excited about it. I can't imagine that it wouldn't continue, but we need you people to help us make
exactly.
it happen.
And I do want to mention too, since you mentioned the Star Reader program, that books you have to read for school, accelerated reader, books that you want to read for other reading programs, other book clubs, that all counts. So we don't want people to feel like, oh, well, I can't read for that because I have to read for this program. Any 100 books that you read in the calendar year will accept, and they don't have to be checked out from the library, but we really do appreciate you checking out from the library as well. And you save yourself some money if you don't go buy all the books. So.
Right. Check it off on there. And, you know, if you're kind of looking around for great books too, NPR's always got a really wonderful book section on their website.
Exactly.
And, of course, my favorite, Maureen Corrigan on Fresh Air, mm-hmm. always has great suggestions for reading.
Absolutely. Perfect. And I feel like listening to NPR, I always go onto their website and look at – I really like young adult literature, and so for me, I always go on and see their best picks for the year, and that's where I get, you know, 90% of my reading material. And young adult literature counts, even if you're an adult, okay?
Okay, so get in all the books you missed as a young adult.
Exactly.
Now. If you are just tuning in, my guests are Emma Guillory and Beth Chasson with the Lafayette Public Library, talking about various programs that are going on at the library right now. There's always a lot happening there. If you haven't been to any of the branches, stop in, see what they have. Some beautiful facilities, and they're working on the main library right now as well. Should be done in a couple years.
We're hoping for that. Yeah, there's some things that are outside of our control, but that's what we're looking at right now. A couple of years.
We'll have you back when that
exactly. We can't wait to come here.
Right. Now, in addition to presenting literary topics, music is also important to you all because the library does lend out music.
And, exactly.
People have often gotten, over the years, whatever form it was in, cassettes or, CDs.
I'm sure at some point we had 8 tracks, but I don't really, that was before our time.
Right. So you have a couple concerts coming up, jazz concerts.
We do. We're very excited about it. We have this award-winning jazz saxophonist, Chanel Latimer. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He's coming in and he's going to do a Sunday jazz concert on Sunday, February 17th, so the day after our romance author panel. That's going to be at 2:30 at the South Regional Library on Johnson Street. And then the next day, on Monday, the 18th, at 4, also at South Regional, he's going to do a performance for kids. So he's going to teach kids the exciting things about jazz and where it came from and how you can express yourself with it and just... It's going to be really exciting for kids. So we're really excited about both of those programs.
Right. And of course, you can bring all of your kids to this. But I'm thinking there are a lot of kids around here who love the saxophone, want to play it in band. Really nice opportunity for them.
Well, and he's also, because it's a program for kids, he's going to make it fun. He's going to have some comedic performances in there. And it's, I think it's going to be really educational, but also just a really fun time.
And the date of that is?
That is Monday, February 18th at 4 o'clock at the South Regional Library on Johnston.
Now, that's for the children. He is giving a more adult concert.
Traditional jazz concert. With a piano accompanist on Sunday, February 17th at 2:30 at South Regional Library as well.
All right, and that's all on your website as well, I'm sure. Yep. And you did want to let people know that particularly all next week during the Mardi Gras holidays, for some kids it's a couple days, for some the whole week, that you all are hoping that
we've
kids visit the library.
We've got tons of stuff for you. Don't stay bored at home. We've got all kinds of programs going on. We've got craft programs revolving around Mardi Gras and Valentine's Day and those kind of themes. We've got movies. It's a whole lot of things. So feel free to check us out, LafayettePublicLibrary.org. We've got a calendar of events on there, and it's got everything listed. We also have some story times, too, for the younger kids. So.
Right. And it's never too late to start. It's never too early, we should say, to start thinking about other times that kids may need activities. And, of course, the summertime looms large in a lot of parents' minds.
What
Absolutely.
Are we
going to be doing this summer? And so your summer reading program will be kicking off in mid-May.
Exactly. We're going to start signing up on May the 20th. People will be able to come and start signing up for summer reading. And then we have our big summer reading kickoff at the South Regional Library on May the 31st. That's a Friday. And people are going to be invited. We're going to have a fun jump. We're going to have all kinds of craft activities that whole day where parents can come in, sign their kids up, check out those first few books for the summer, and it's just a really fun kickoff to our summer, and I think we're excited about it, so hope everybody can kind of mark it on their calendars and save the date.
Right, and if the families start up with that 100 book club, maybe some of the kids will already be in that habit. Of
that's
reading.
It. They'll be
and
nearly done with their list by that point.
That's our plan, we hope. But certainly any books that are read over the summer, again, even if they're assigned by your school, they count. So they count for summer reading, our summer reading programs, which we have prizes for, and they also count for the 100 book club.
I'm in library school right now, and I'm counting my textbooks that I'm reading as my books as well. So,
you're reading them very carefully.
I'm reading them, okay?
Well, and just talking about the book club, I know there are a lot of people listening right now who remember as, children, the summer programs that they were involved with very fondly, mm-hmm. in the little prizes, the pictures, everything that went along with it. And that's a really nice part of a kid's summer is those reading programs at the library.
And it not only does it give them something to do, it gives them something to achieve. It gives them, that excitement of being able to, for the little children we have, it's based on time. So you get to fill in the shapes of each 10 minutes you read or whatever. So they get to fill it in. They get to, they're all excited because I get to fill in another star or whatever. And then for the teens, because we have a separate program for teens, they can log their books online. So they can have a record of all of the books that they've read. They can share their reviews with other, peers and that kind of thing. So I think it's something they really get excited about.
Yeah, that's a really nice element, that sharing aspect of this the social
exactly.
media now.
Definitely. And also, just a reminder, we also have an adult summer reading program as well. And we usually have a good giveaway Library for adults and for teens as well, and they can log their books on. And then with the 100 Book Club, you can share the books that you've read on Facebook. So I know that I'm logging my books every time I read one, and so my friends are saying, I don't know if you're going to be able to do it. 100 books is a lot. So it's like I'm putting myself out there to, you know, be responsible, to be accountable for reading these 100 books. So it's been a good motivator for me.
Right. Well, you know, anyone listening right now has got to take hope about the future of reading, you know, because there's all kinds of discussion about that. You know, what is the future of the book and reading? And I think on Fresh Air NPR yesterday afternoon, they were talking with the man who's head of Little Brown. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be the CEO for the entire publishing group. But he was just talking about how all these different platforms that you're mentioning are actually making reading a much wider activity. Well, and that it's maybe not the traditional
paper in hand, but it's still.
And I was going to say, we don't really discriminate. If you want to read an ebook or you want to read paper book, we've got it. We've got both. And we've seen that our ebook checkouts have been increasing very steadily over the past few years, but they're not anywhere close to overtaking paper books. But even if they do, we're still there to provide it to you. If you're reading, we don't care which kind you read.
And it's important for people to remember, I think, when they're considering ebooks, and you know, if somebody logs in and they don't find a book available on our ebook collection, you know that we've had 30 years to keep up with our paper collection, but it's in its beginning stages, and so we're definitely putting a lot of money into our ebook collection, and it's the best thing in the world if it's in the middle of the night and you don't have anything to read and you can lay in bed and check out a book. It's the coolest thing in the world. So I highly recommend people go to our website and check out our ebook service as well.
Just expands our options for reading and encourages us to read more. Again, my guests, Emma Guillory, Beth Chasson with the Lafayette Public Library, obviously passionate about reading and books and everything that's going on at the library. Again, we do cover many, many parishes. Check out your parish libraries. Find out what there is to offer. If you are in Lafayette Parish, these activities are taking place this week and next with the romance Stories with Heart.
That's Saturday, February the 16th at 2 p.m. at the South Regional Library.
All fans of romance literature can
come on down.
Yes, and listen to these wonderful authors, and also they'll be signing their books as well.
And book sale as well.
All right. And then next week with Mardi Gras, lots of activities happening for kids at the libraries.
Plenty. And I would definitely recommend that people look at our website, LafayettePublicLibrary.org, to see all the different events going on at different times so that they can find something that fits with their schedule.
And you know, the question they always ask at NPR, and I need to ask it, is what have you been reading, Emma? Besides your textbooks.
Textbooks, which you can't see me, but I'm rolling my eyes. I actually just finished a light kind of romance-ish kind of book, and it was an easy read, and it was a 1-2-3 kind of book. So I'm done with that. And then I have one of the Newbery winners, I believe, that got a mention. I'm going to be reading that next. And it's about a gorilla and a dog that are best friends. So
young people's books, a great passion of yours as well. And how about you, Beth?
Oh, it's a bad question for me, but I'm also in school, so I am reading some textbooks, and I have a little 2-year-old. So I'm reading a lot of picture books.
Well,
we both have 2-year-olds, and so we've been laughing and talking about reading a timeout book to our children because they're very much in the timeout phase right now. So
the Caldecott Award books are important. Too.
Exactly.
The picture books. Well, just again, no matter how you read, all books are great, no matter what kind of platform they're on, and you all are trying to make that as easy as possible for everyone. So stop by their website, find out more about what's being offered at the library. Closest is that panel on the romance novelists. Again, Emma Guillory, Beth Chasson, thank you so much for taking time out, and we look forward to hearing more about what the libraries are doing. Maybe have you back right before the summer reading
program. That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is Thursday afternoon when KRVS presents From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque, reading works by writers from or inspired by Louisiana.
Today's two poems are by Cheryl St. Germain, and they appear in Shabdagucha, a bilingual poetry journal edited by Hassanal Abdullah. Cheryl's first poem is Cajun. I want to take the word back into my body, back from the northern restaurants with their neon signs announcing it like a whore. I want it to be private again. I want to sink back into the swamps that are nothing like these clean restaurants, the swamps with their mud and jaws and eyes that float below the surface, the mud and jaws and eyes of food or death. I want to see my father's hands again, scarred with a life of netting and trapping, thick gunk of bayou under his fingernails, staining his cuticles. I want to remember the pride he took gutting and cleaning what he caught. His were nothing like the soft hands and clipped fingernails that serve us in these restaurants cemented in land, the restaurants nothing like the houses we lived and died in, anchored in water, trembling with every wind and flood, and what my father's mother knew, how to make alligator tail sweet, how to cut up mussel, squirrel, or rabbit, or wild duck, cook it till it was tender, spice it, and mix it all up with rice that soaked up the spice and the game so that it all filled your mouth thick and sticky, tasting like blood and cayenne. And when I see the signs on the restaurants, Cajun food served here, it's like a fish knife ripping my belly. And when I see them all eating the white meat of fat chickens and market cuts of steak or fish someone else has caught and cooked Cajun style, I feel it again. The word's been stolen. Like me, gutted. Second poem by Cheryl St. Germain, Searching for the Ancestors. I walk almost lost on a tiny black mountain trail of a French summer in this land of another way to say yes, land of Cathars and chestnuts, Cassoulet and Canard, land of grapes and wines that could pull me away from the path at any moment, bloody land of many wars, land of many dead, land of abandoned graves, land of ancestors, some of whom neither wrote nor read nor spoke my tongue. And yet something stops me here. I, who am not religious, I who wish for faith but fail in it, I who trust logic above all though find no healing there, am struck by the whispering of something in the land itself. Some sound of these cypress trees thousands of years old, these ghostly paths and crumbling stone fences, the perfume of this mountain air calling out, almost familiar, a voice of sound and color and smell, come, it says, sir, cousin, fille d'Amérique, bienvenue chez nous, welcome home. What else could I say to such a voice? I'm coming. I say we. I say ok. I say yes.
Join KRVS each Thursday afternoon for From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque. And joining me in the Care VS studios now is painter John Hathorn, here to talk about an exhibit that opens at the Acadiana Center for the Arts this Saturday called John Hathorn, A Retrospective. And I have a beautiful, beautiful catalog here in front of me that comes along with the show, beautifully designed and printed, and it really does justice to the beauty of your work, John.
Thank you.
I know that you and the ACA have been working on this exhibit for a long time now, planning
it,
looking forward to it, and then you just collecting these pieces. And so it was quite a task between you and the curators. Mary Bate worked on this.
Mary Bate and Brian Guidry, the co-curators. It's been about a 15-month process from the initial invitation for the retrospective. And initially, in conversation with Mary and Brian, because we're looking at essentially a 30-year retrospective and obviously one can make a lot of work in 30 years. And it's such a beautiful space. And, of course, the large gallery is over 4,000 square feet. So to do a retrospective made sense, you know, in terms of really looking at the breadth of a career.
Right. And so fortunate for all of us who don't get as many opportunities to see your work. And some people may have seen a piece here and there at some collections, exhibits around town. Many of our listeners may have not had the opportunity to see your work.
Well, it's interesting. You speaking of that kind of opportunity, what's a real luxury for me is to do precisely the same thing in that Mary and Brian, because they're both visual artists, they're both painters, whom I have a great deal of trust in. So it's a luxury to be able to turn it over to them. They take care of the installation, and certainly they put that together in a way that is very different than I might have done, and it allows me to be able to certainly look at my own work through their eyes and through juxtapositions that they establish, again, that I certainly would not have. I think one is seldom objective about your own work in that sense, and so it's nice to have some distance and some space where someone in whom you have a lot of faith takes that task up.
Well, and I think Mary and Brian's work has really made me feel that curating is an art in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Every exhibit I've seen that they put together is a piece of art in itself.
They're extremely good at what they do.
Now, one of the things about radio is that we're a little handicapped. I can't show pictures of your work here on the radio. So we're going to describe some pieces and talk just a bit about your background, and hopefully people will take that opportunity to go and see the exhibit. You've been here at the university for 31 years.
That's right.
Here at UL Lafayette. Mm-hmm. But you're not from Louisiana.
No.
And I think people can still hear a softness in your voice.
No.
That.
No, I grew up in Oxford, Mississippi, and studied at the University of Mississippi.
Land of Faulkner.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yonkin Potawatomi County. And then did my graduate work at Florida State, and then came to Lafayette directly from there, from Tallahassee. I've often said when I made that transition that I thought it was probably going to be a one-year gig, possibly two, and then, of course, that's turned into three decades.
So. This area has that way.
It does
that
indeed.
Influence on
yes,
other people. But let's talk just a bit about that part of Mississippi, because obviously there's something fertile there, for whether you're a literary artist, visual artist. What is it about that place?
Well,
when did you develop an interest in images?
You know, I really was in the university before I really began to, I think, have a sense of, first of all, it was the first time I studied the visual arts in a formal sense. And even though there's this, you're aware of this mystique in this area, I mean, primarily because of Faulkner, but there are numerous other writers and well-known writers who, of course, are not just from North Mississippi, but but an even tighter arena.
Eudora Welty, who was also a photographer.
Lydon Jackson, who is, few people know much about her photography, but it's extraordinarily beautiful images. So it's, of course, you know, one of the things that Darrell Bourque spoke to in his essay in the catalog was the border of the Mississippi Delta. And there's, you know, you move between the Delta land, the river territory, into the more hill region of the central northern part of the state, and there's I don't know, geography shifts, but there's such a richness there. In some ways, although it's very different from this area, there is there's something very special about that part of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't even have to have read Faulkner to feel that mystique.
Oh,
we all know the stories and the characters from that area. And, of course, Walker Percy was
from that area, Greenville area and again, that part of the Delta.
So, again, something very fertile. So you weren't a child that spent your days with a notebook sketching?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. I think I was a senior in high school when I had a first course and then, again, was introduced to basically my freshman year, I entered the visual arts. So it was I spent a great deal of time outdoors as a child, but it was not a background for me that was in any way really nurtured through childhood in terms of being pushed in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the images, what were the influences during your undergraduate time that began to draw you towards painting?
You know, I studied with a painter by the name of Jerry Allen. And Jerry was a figurative painter, but he's probably the first artist that I really began to get a sense, an understanding of what I often speak of as the physicality of paint. I mean, the sheer physical energy of the material. And I learned so much from him, both in terms of drawing and in terms of painting. But he was a seminal influence, and even though my work is not at all like Jerry's, and Jerry's about 10 years older than I am. But he gave me this stimulus, this awareness at the age of 18 and 19 that that's never left me, and I'm indebted to him for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something I think anyone who has ever seen your work is aware of is the paint itself.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when we look at art, we think of the design, we think of the color, but not necessarily that medium.
Right.
But you can't get away from that in your work.
Right.
That feeling of the paint is something tangible, substantial.
Yeah, it's just an incurable disease for me. I mean, the idea of being able to have this physical, tangible, tactile quality in the work and that sensibility. So I'm happily addicted to the to the matter.
So that started early on in your college career and continued.
That awareness did, yes.
Yeah. So how did you – because obviously when someone looks at this retrospective, when they go to see the exhibit or see the catalog, there's a real development in style and imagery and poetics your work.
Yeah.
So that's changed a lot over the years. Start us off on your journey there.
Well, it has, although it's – and even though I think the viewer will be very aware of this in terms of these moving through diverse bodies of work. There is, I think, and I think the viewer will also feel the same, a fairly significant thread of continuity that moves through the work, whether it has to do with formal elements, the color or space, a pictorial space. But to answer your question, much of the work, almost all of the work is non-representational. It's abstract painting. And the work tends to be a bit more minimal in the early in mid-1980s. I'm working with a lot of fields of color, large blocks of color, and often there's a strong figurative element, one or more figures in a larger space. And so then the work begins to get a bit more complex in the late 80s, in the early 90s. Actually, in the late 80s, I switched from oil paint to working in acrylic, mainly because I simply I couldn't seem to resolve a painting. Obviously,
thick of oil wouldn't dry ever.
oil that's right, it doesn't dry, and so if you for whatever reason at the time it was very frustrating. So I simply said, I'll force my hand to make this transition. And shifting to acrylics, of course, because it dries so rapidly, you have to make decisions construct a painting in a very different way. Ironically, about 5 to 6 years later, the reverse happened, that I simply couldn't seem to keep a painting wet enough, long enough to do what I needed to do. So I made the transition yet again. Mm. And basically for the last 20 years have been working in oil paint almost exclusively.
Once more. Well, because it's very interesting, the essays, Daryl Bourke and Virginia Bio Anderson, they obviously talk about this medium of paint, which is so important to you and has been all along. But they also pull out those elements, which are so obvious in your titles as well.
Right.
So I guess I want to go back to some of those things. Because
okay.
the paint is your medium, but there were things that drove you to create ideas and right. Characters, painters, poets, musicians.
Right.
When did your interest in those people begin to develop? Graduate school?
I began to read poetry in graduate school, but it was really several years later before it became something that was really significant and began to emerge as subject matter in my work. In the early 90s, I did a body of work in response to the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and that's from that point I really began to focus a great deal on poetry as a stimulus, and thinking about the relations between painting and poetry, music as well. But music was never quite as direct of an influence for me. Although I've had some formal training, it did not emerge quite as vital as poems did.
Mm. And Rilke worked with Rodin, didn't he?
Rilke was the Rodin's secretary, yeah. as probably in his early 20s, and I think held that job for 2 or 3 years before Rodin fired him. But
so he was around a very powerful artist,
absolutely,
a very powerful
right,
medium,
who had an enormous influence mm-hmm. on him. And in fact, speaking of that as well, I mean Rodin is. One of those individuals that I have been drawn to for quite a while as well, and again, even though he is a figurative sculptor, I think some of the same sensuousness of material, of matter, even though it may be clay or stone or marble or plaster, it's an interesting connection. But
yeah, so I think people wonder, you know, when you're inspired by another artist or a poet, mm-hmm. a writer, how does that translate? You're not making realistic, figurative translations
right.
of a poem. You're not painting a picture of a swan
yes.
or a tree.
Yes.
What happens when you're inspired by a poet?
That's a great question, because I think very often when we have a conversation along these lines or one hears about those sorts of inspirations, you're looking for a kind of illustration. And I have no interest in that. I'm much more interested in a kind of a visceral response, a response in which I can not interpret the work so much, but simply respond to that. For the viewer, other than title, and in many cases in the later works where I'm incorporating text, my own handwriting into the paintings, there's very little there that would provide the viewer with that connection. So it's fairly oblique. It's a kind of more of a private conversation, I think. And
We're privileged to kind of peek into and, I guess, experience.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so.
Well, tell us a bit about some of these people. Rilke is very important, Baudelaire.
Right.
What about Rilke? What are you responding to in him? And what can people expect to, I guess, what sort of emotional response
I think in Rilke, there's such a respect for dignity of whether it's another human being, of an animal, of an inanimate object. And there's a kind of quietude in Rilke's work. It's very meditative. But as someone who is essentially, like Baudelaire, on the verge, opening all sorts of doors for modernism. He was a very pivotal figure. And so for both of those individuals, they're such a respect for language, mm-hmm. and in Baudelaire's case, in fact, there are more works in the exhibition that this body of work called the Baudelaire Sketches, and it's interesting because Baudelaire in his own lifetime was relatively tragic in terms of the absence of support that he experienced.
He was a French poet, a young French poet.
And in his work, it was emerging in the 1840s, 1850s, and 60s. But Baudelaire's, his most famous work, Les Fleurs de Mal, the Flowers of Evil, received such brutal criticism in its day, in fact, was censored in part. and which is very interesting because today we look at that as the seminal work that Baudelaire produced. And so it's been there are a number of poems from that collection that have specifically been of interest to me, and I have responded to those. But it's always an indirect response to that work. Mm-hmm. As I said, more of a private conversation, I think.
Right. I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest is painter John Hathorn. He will have a retrospective at the Acadiana Center for the Arts opening this Saturday. He has been a professor here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette for 31 years now, and this is a retrospective of work that he's been doing since the beginning.
Right.
What year is the first painting in the exhibit?
1983.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure people who have experienced your work remember certain phases of it, maybe the first painting or piece they ever saw about it. And everyone has their own private conversation relationship to some of your work as well. And just looking through the catalog, I think everyone will be satisfied with the different periods that are there. But there, you know, when you talk about it being a private conversation, I do remember those experiences being in front of some of your works and feeling very quiet, almost as if you're listening, almost as if you are resting in that moment that you're creating with something else.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. I mean, that's the kind of response that that I would hope for, and that I myself experience for some of the work.
Yeah.
But that's kind of presence, that sort of meditative conversation or correspondence is what I hope for.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, let's look at some of the different phases of your work. Many people may be familiar with the pieces you've done with objects hung with string. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
When I was in graduate school, my thesis really evolved around a fairly kind of crude in the sense of simple, of figurative presence, again, in a large canvas space. And I was using the term scarecrow for a number of these pieces in this particular body of work. And I think from that, there was a kind of single figurative reference. And in some cases, I think a number of viewers might respond to it as kind of a cruciform image. But out of that, the idea of a suspension or a singular presence that is held up or not necessarily bound, but open to the viewer in terms of a kind of an isolated presence, I think started that work. And the idea, I also think it tends to go back to childhood, simply playing, constructing things that children do in terms of play spaces, be it houses or fortresses or what have you. Mm-hmm. And so I think a sense of handling materials and a kind of architectural play was important to me as a child. And, mm-hmm. and I think it simply has carried over, 50 years later. So,
but your particular choice of string, of color, of object, these are not crude hangings of objects off of blocks with thick string. They're very, very particular choices you made about how it feels to look at those objects. And what's behind that?
I think working with a mixture of materials, whether it happens to be, as you suggest, a very thin thread, that's tied to stone or enveloped in cloth or juxtaposed with wood. Those kinds of very often foreign materials or foreign juxtapositions interest me in that you're bringing something together that very often makes very little sense in terms of their natural kind of ability to work together, and so in that sense they're rather strange constructions, these particularly the small ones that I make, but it's a kind of poetic blending of materials, and again they, like the paintings, are essentially non-objective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, something very, very delicate. They may be strange, but there's certainly nothing. There's something elegant, and it makes you want to stand in front of it. It's like everything just hangs plumb, and
well, that's
a perfection.
That's a key term too in the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one thinks about a plumb or what we refer to as something which is true or straight or vertical, what have you, that metaphorically, that interests me a great deal in the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now, where did you go from there? Because, there are some people who have seen just those thick, luscious paintings that you have. What was the process from these more delicate surfaces using objects?
You know, I'm often working on these things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. In fact, after constructing a large body of work, perhaps a year, for example, where I'm working on canvases that may be 6 feet or 7 feet, it's very nice to move to a material, to a medium that is much more intimate, or where you simply physically you approach it in a different way, and it's a kind of break. It's a pause or an interval. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I very much like the idea of moving between large and small scale, between working on canvas, between working with three-dimensional constructions. There's a large construction in the exhibition called Raft, which is about a 6x6 approximately foot wooden platform. Indeed, it looks like a raft. But it's suspended from the ceiling like a number of the smaller objects, and some of those objects attached to canvas. But it contains a wide range of what I refer to as objects of affection. And I think in speaking to the small constructions, which many of which are suspended, it's that blending. It's those objects which we're drawn to, or we admire, or we find beautiful, even if they perhaps have a kind of irrational union. It's simply that, for me, that poetic sensibility of putting things together that feel right, or that
which
that,
all poets do as well, with those metaphors with language, that make our mind startle.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, tell us just a bit about color. Because I think people are fascinated by your color as well. Sometimes there's a very subtle, and then sometimes just bright bursts of color. What moves you with color?
I think the majority of the work, and again, one's not always particularly objective about your own observations in your own work. I think the viewers will tend to find the work relatively subtle, mm-hmm. and in terms of low-keyed, a lot of grays, sort of ochre, earth tone colors. And then I often use red, for example, as a I don't know that the word accent is a particularly apt term, but in a smaller quantity as sort of a significant focal point or a means by which one sort of finds a what I call a key mark or a sort of a catalyst that allows you to enter a work and then move around the work from that. Mm-hmm. So the more intense colors tend to be more minimal, mm-hmm. And operating within a range of whether it's a lot of paint or whether it's a very sort of minimal canvas with a lot of exposed raw canvas. Generally a very subtle use of color. Mm-hmm. The neutrals, whites, blacks, have been really critical and consistent for the last 30 years. And I think the viewer moving through this exhibition will definitely see that continuity. Mm-hmm.
I think I've heard a lot of people comment on how true those colors are, that there's no false note when you see the colors in your paintings. I mean, your choice of red, many shades of red, many shades of blue.
Right.
How do you go about choosing those shades?
You know, that's something I'm not sure that one can very easily explain in a sense.
Pulling them out of a Crayola box.
A moment ago, I chose to use the word rightness in terms of sort of intuitively feeling whether it's something that you touch or this. I often refer to the touch sensibility of whether it's paint or fabric or string or whatever the material is. But that intuitive understanding that this is right or it's not right, and you continue to sort of push and move along, and however cumbersome that process may be, to sort of figure out what to do until you get it right. And of course, that's true of of almost any creative process.
I think many of the people seeing it, your paintings think they're pitch perfect, those colors. I want to tell you, if you're just joining us, my guest is painter John Hathorn. Opening this Saturday at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in downtown Lafayette is a retrospective of his work. He's been here at the university for over 30 years now, painting and developing his poetry of painting, and we have this lovely opportunity to see it this Saturday. It opens, but Art Walk is the following Saturday.
That's correct, the 16th.
The 16th. So right. There will be a reception. You can meet John, talk right. to him, and get to see his paintings. And then later on in the month of March, there will be a gallery talk, and we'll mention that in a little while. Right. In addition to poets, and we could talk a really long time about
sure.
all your the poetry and the poets who inspire you, there are other inspirations. There are several pieces that have to do with Copernicus.
Right, yes.
What is that? What drew you to Copernicus?
About a decade ago, I was doing quite a bit of reading on Galileo and Copernicus, and I think that was coming out of a place where I was interested not only in those two scientists, but others for whom were living in a time and experiencing certainly a great deal of conflict between science and theology. They were certainly looking for a kind of spirituality in that merger between art and science, which interests me a great deal. And so the fact that these two individuals receive such harsh treatment from not only their peers, but certainly whether it was the church or the state or other scientists, and that perseverance that those two individuals, and there are certainly many others, that interests me, the extent to which they are seeking this thing that is unknown, that it's out there. They have this sort of gut sensibility of the fact that, you know, somehow we don't quite have it right yet in terms of this notion of, for example, where we are in relation to the sun and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I have a great deal of respect for their courage and for trusting one's intuition and your common sense and how you see the world and understand that. And also, again, seeking something that's truthful, that's obviously meaningful.
You know, just hearing you talk about these pieces, I guess I always try and encourage people, Art Walk's going to be wonderful and they can talk to you and it's going to be a lovely time, but encourage people to try to go back to these exhibits by themselves and just spend time with the paintings.
I hope so. I think that's... as wonderful as the openings are and the public social events, it's very difficult, and particularly at Art Walk, to really see the work.
And to hear your conversation with these poets and scientists and writers.
Sure. So I hope that the viewers will do that, that they will return and have a kind of quietude with the work, because that's I think the work asks for that. The work speaks to that, I hope. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly encourage people to try to do the same thing.
Yeah. How long will the exhibit be out?
It's through March the 13th, so it's basically a two-month retrospective show, and which is you know, it's a very generous block of time, and I'm so appreciative of the opportunity and of Gerd Westman and again Brian and Mary and all of the ACA. Community and staff who has sort of made this a very, very gracious, open, warm opportunity for me, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, well, we can't stress that word opportunity enough. And one of the other reasons it's such an opportunity is that many of these pieces are in private collections.
That's right.
This is not something that we will see after this exhibit. Except
a number more. I did not. Attempt to bring works in from private collections outside of the region, because it's just cost prohibitive with shipping and transportation. But and frankly, I